Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Murphy-DeGincini. Today I'm back talking with a dear friend of mine, Scott Selden. Scott, welcome back to the podcast.
It's great to be here. It's great to be sharing this time with you.
In part one of the episode, we had talked a lot about our history together, the ins and outs of navigating college and graduate school, or prepping for graduate school. And we touched briefly on your memoir, My Out of the Blue Stories. And we didn't get to the meat of what I felt was the most important part of the book. So, welcome to part two. To catch everyone up, where you have actually mentioned me twice in two out of the three books you've written. And I have tried to find your first, and I cannot. I've scoured the internet, and it is out of print. The page of My Out of the Blue Stories, which features me, is on page 149. And it's the disability and ability of love. During the years that I walked at the College of Santa Fe, I coached many students who had diagnosed disabilities. This story is about someone named Daniel. But before I introduce you to him, I'll share a few relevant paragraphs from a book I wrote, Mentoring Human Potential, published in 2011 by iUniverse. Quote, step into the world of your mentees as you step more deeply into your world. Is your limited ability to love turning those with documented disabilities into others? Keith Murphy, name used with permission, it's a student I mentored who has cerebral palsy. I excerpt from a sermon Keith wrote and gave at his church in Washington, D.C. Quote, having a disability is challenging, but it shouldn't lead to a depressed life. However, it often does because of the mindset people without disabilities have towards people with them. A friend and mentor, Scott Selden, suggested I write a piece entitled The Disability of Love. I was intrigued by the concept. We all have a disability, whether we know it or not, accepted or rejected. It is the need for love, the lack of awareness we bring to our inability to love. It's the disability that haunts us all. It is the common ground of life. Your memoir, Out of the Blue Story, it's just to remind people, is a collection of over 60 stories, most of them snapshots into that year and that period of your life. It's a very engaging book because it's very sparse, but it's also very hearty and filling. It doesn't overstay its welcome, and it's very direct. And I've read it completely through two or three times because I'm so captivated by the stories, and this is apart from our friendship. The amount of stories, both light and dark, that has shaped how you both relate and mentor people, be them students, advocates, fellow advisors, fellow colleagues. If you didn't have those stories, those exact stories in your life that shaped your formative years up until the point that you created the mentoring program at the College of Santa Fe, one, you might not have taken the job at the College of Santa Fe. And even if you did, your relatability, your mentoring style may have been completely different, if not non-existent. You've gone through, as we all do, stories and experiences that are both light and empowering and informative. And you've also gone through stories and experiences of darkness that have challenged you. You cannot live a life without both, and you cannot live and benefit your fellow human through acts of love and service, which is one of your mottos that I carry with me to this day, without embracing both and trying to unravel and make sense of how both experiences throughout life shape you into a better model for a human being to empower others.
It comes down to a deep understanding and appreciation and awe of the human condition itself. The human condition contains within itself light and dark. And the more open we are to both, the deeper our experience as human beings. At least that's my approach. There's nothing that isn't miraculous about our existence on this planet. Nothing. So whatever you think about yourself, whatever mistakes you've made, whatever successes, whatever anything, everything to me pales of being a space, the stars at night, the magic is, it's awe-inspiring to me. And so being open, a lot of the experiences that are in the book came from being open to what might be termed mystical, being open to what might be a chance meeting where you don't know, you totally don't expect what happens, but it happens. And how you react reveals a lot about yourself. So one of the things we'll get in later is that I now, I work with people who are writing their memoirs. And as a coach, this is really interesting. When people explore their own lives, that's what is often a catalyst for personal growth and change, which is what we, I think, all want from our existence. We want to be better human beings, but we want to understand that dark side as well.
So there are so many stories in this book you could read to give the listeners a little taste of the cosmic balance of experiences you've been through in your life. You have a few selected already. Would you preview those each first before you read them to really set the scene?
Well, let's see. The first story that I want to read takes place in 1975. So that's what, 47, 48 years ago, something like that. And I'm living with my wife in New York City. You know, sometimes you just wake up in a bad mood. You haven't had enough sleep.
I constantly know what that's like.
I think we all do. And just living in this world, it's just like one problem's thrown after another at you, and you're doing the best you can. But some days are just darker than other days, even though the sun may be shining brightly. And this story takes place August 1975, and the title of it is "I'm Not in the Mood." These are brief stories, but they'll give you a sense of the spirit with which I've written this memoir. I'm going to turn on this little light here so I can see what I've written. Sandy and I are living in a studio apartment close to Washington Square Park in New York City, in New York City's Greenwich Village. Mid-August, early afternoon, on the hottest day of the year, I've gone food shopping. I'm walking east on Christopher Street, carrying two full bags of groceries, sweating from the heat, unable to shake a bad mood caused by getting only a few hours of sleep the night before. Someone steps up to me from behind and presses what feels like the barrel of a gun against my back. He says, "Give me your money or I'll blow your fucking head off." I turn my head, look at him over my shoulder, hoping to get a quick read. Is he scared? Crazy? I can't tell. He's wearing a cap and sunglasses. I say, "It's 100 degrees out. I'm carrying two heavy bags. I'm tired, and you're mugging me? I'm not in the mood." I continue to walk toward our apartment. He again presses the same object against my back and says, "Maybe you didn't hear me." I said, Give me your money or I'll blow your fucking head off. I look into his sunglasses. Maybe you didn't hear me, I tell him. I'm tired. I'm carrying two heavy bags on a very hot day. I'm not in the mood. His mouth opens slightly, and I walk into the middle of Christopher Street. I see two men across the street who have stopped to watch the mugging. I turn back to the man still standing where he tried to mug me. He runs west on the sidewalk and dashes north on a side street. I cross the street to where the two men are standing, and one of them says, "It looked like he was mugging you." "Yeah," I say, "he tried to." "What happened?" "I told him I was tired. I was carrying two heavy bags on a very hot day, and I wasn't in the mood." "Could have gone a different way," the other man says. "You were lucky." I agree. Yes, I agree. I was lucky. I walk home and put my groceries away, thinking that was the dumbest thing you've ever done. A few days later, I buy a second wallet and put 10 single dollar bills in it with a few business cards. If I'm ever mugged again, I won't hesitate. I'll give the mugger the wallet with the 10 singles in it. So that's New York. That's me in New York. And there is that darkness that's a survival darkness, that it's like, I don't take any crap from anybody. And it was expressed at the wrong time, at a very dangerous time for me. But when you go through a lot of stuff, you never know how you're going to react. And we all do make mistakes. And that was a big one that I made.
So my question is, did you ever get mugged again?
No, I never did. I never did. And I feel I was, in some odd way, maybe I was humoring God that day, but I was protected. I felt protected because, as the man said, it could have gone the other way.
Yes, and it usually does.
And usually does.
Particularly in New York.
Especially in New York.
'70s.
And anyone who, and people who've read that think, what are you, crazy man? How could you?
Yeah. When I first read that story, I'm like, okay, I know this man, but this has to be fantastical, embellished for creative, but no, it's not. No. But it seems like it is one of those stories that I studied creative writing at the College of Santa Fe, and this would have been one of those stories that I would have written, and everyone in the class would have called BS on. Yeah. Because I know it happened, because I know you, but yeah. It's like, it just sounds, wow, you got so lucky there. Yeah. And it's like, so that's a case of the darkness, and there are plenty of dark stories, but they all, regardless of darkness or light, they all carry a moral, a lesson, something to take away from, without being overly preachy or philosophical, which is another thing I like about your book. It's almost written like very direct, short fiction, and yet none of the stories, again, are embellished.
Yeah.
And we talked offline about two stories that I had, which you had included, including one that, if we have time, we'll get to, that I completely misremember. But humorous moment. So what are some of the lightness experiences in the book?
Okay, this is a story that was written that happened 2 years later. And I just wanted to say that not embellishing, telling things exactly as I recall them, and I have a good memory for these stories and actually the conversations that took place. So that was one of the most important things for me, was to not embellish, because there's, for want of a word, some people attract certain kinds of experiences. And who knows the reason why that is? But I think the reason it's called My Out of the Blue Stories, because things happen just out of the blue, as they do to all of us. Sometimes I think we don't notice that some very strange things are happening around us, and other times we do. But that's the nature of a lot of these stories.
Yes.
So this story, summer of 1977, the title is A Chance Meeting. I'm standing in front of Balducci's Market, 6th Avenue and West 9th Street in Manhattan, enjoying a summer breeze, feeling relaxed, feeling good. A radiantly beautiful woman with red hair steps from the flow of people walking on the sidewalk and approaches me. She stops with her face about 2 feet from mine. We smile at each other. She looks into my eyes and embraces me lovingly in her arms. I don't say, "What do you think you're doing?" I don't say anything. She gently presses her lips against mine. I figure she's mistaking me for an old boyfriend of hers. What the hell? She parts her lips and we kiss passionately for about 2 minutes. Then we hug and she says, "I'm tripping on LSD. I ask, "How's your trip?" "Beautiful. The city is a jewel. We're all jewels. Have you kissed other strangers today?" "No, just you." "When did you take the acid?" "Early this morning with my boyfriend. I wanted to go for a walk. He wanted to play his trumpet. He's a musician. He's back at our apartment, 28th and 6th. Are you going back now?" "Yes." "Do you want to walk with me and meet Tom?" "Sure." We walk north on the sidewalk. I ask, "What is your LSD trip like?" She stops walking, touches my face, and takes my hand to her face. "Everything is beautiful," she says. "You, me, the buildings, the sidewalk." "Are you hallucinating?" "For a while, I saw faces in the buildings, but mostly no. I'm having a wonderful day." At 28th Street, we walk to the building where she lives, enter the lobby, and take an elevator to the 4th floor. As the elevator doors open, we hear the distant sound of a trumpet, which grows louder as we walk down the hall. She opens her apartment door, and I follow her into the studio with large windows overlooking 28th Street. Standing in front of a window, facing us, is a young man with curly brown hair, playing a trumpet, wearing only boxer shorts. He stops playing and moves the trumpet a few inches from his mouth. Then he lowers the trumpet and gives me a what's up look. Hi, I say. Who are you? He asks. I'm Scott. Why are you here? I shrug. A chance meeting. She says, I kissed him in front of Balducci's. He walked me home. He plays a riff on his trumpet. She tells me he'd like you to leave now. Okay, I say, and I walk with her to the front door. She smiles at me and says, trippy. I laugh, very trippy. She opens the door and closes it behind me. I walk home.
Yeah, very trippy indeed. I mean, there are so many things you can say, or that one can ask about both stories, and that's just a small sampling. Now, because the latter one had a musician, we had mentioned offline over the phone something about your wife meeting John Lennon by chance multiple times.
Well, this is just briefly, I'm careful to change someone's name or with stories or ask permission.
Yeah.
So just in brief, the story was that she was working in New York and she went in to get some lunch, a takeout place, and John Lennon came in and she smiled. He smiled at her and he ordered and left. And when she got home, she mentioned that she had met John Lennon and seen him in this restaurant. And she said, and I think it was a Wednesday, she said, I wonder if he'll be back there same time next week. And I said, it's John Lennon. You think
John Lennon
is run by a clock like that? You know, he's so regimented that Wednesday at 12:15, he'll be back there. And so the next Wednesday at 12:15, she was in this restaurant and John Lennon came in as he had the week before. They smiled at each other. He ordered and he left. And I learned something from that.
Do you mind telling us what you learned from it?
Well, that we're all, if he was in a recording studio nearby, his life is as ruled by time, which is baffling, whatever time is, in the same way that they take a break at noon. He gets his stuff together. He walks out of the place. He goes down to the restaurant nearby.
Yeah,
and it's no different in some ways from all of our lives, which are run by the clock.
And so there are a lot of stories in the book, and all of them are fascinating, but the one we didn't get to really explore last time, we covered so much of our own personal history, is the reason for the episode. You had highlighted on the passage you quoted me that after working with me several years, after working with me and other students with diagnosed disabilities at the College of Santa Fe, you continued that work as a mentor for people with disabilities. One of them is a man named Daniel who has autism, and that story was one of the longest in the book, but extremely moving, and really you take what you've learned throughout your life up into that point and are able to relate and work with this individual just like you worked with anyone else before or since, and talk about what you were able to impart to Daniel, but more so what he taught you about transforming the disability of love, the inability of love, or to love, into the ability to love, because that's one of the final stories, and it really brings the majority of the lessons from the previous stories in my Out of the Blue stories together in a very beautiful way.
When I met Daniel, there was a woman who was living with him in the house, a caregiver, a young woman about in her 30s, early 30s. And Daniel was living there as well. And she had a job outside of the house as well. And I was interviewed for work, the job of working with him and taking him to places that he really liked to go to, taking him on hikes, taking him bowling, having lunch with him, ice skating, and lots of other things as well. And this story, I hope, will talk about what you go through, what a person who is working with somebody with disabilities should go through in order to make it work. And the ability of love, let's start with that. Always be authentic. You want to always be authentic in being a loving person. That's the best in us. And so in the early weeks, and I would say even after a month or two, Daniel shut me out of his world. We would go, we would do all these things, but he really made it clear. And once when I was at the ice rink in Santa Fe, he came off the ice and he came up to me and he said, "Just go home. You know, just go home. I don't want you here." And I had to just stay centered and tell him that this is my job and that I like him. I like him as a person. And that in time I think that I'm a good person, and I think that in time he'll like me as well. And to just give me some time to be who I am with him. I don't ask him to be anything other than who he is. And but he really shut me out for a considerable length of time, but I just stayed who I am. And then one day I was driving him up West San Francisco Street in Santa Fe, and in front of us was the beautiful Cathedral Basilica. And he turned to me and he said that cathedral reminds me of Notre Dame. And to me, that was an opening to engage in a conversation that I had not had with him up to that point. And so I asked him, oh, you were in Paris? You were, were you with your family? Yes, went through all of that. And then I asked him, would you like to go into the cathedral basilica now? I could park the car. We could go in and spend the time that you want. He said, yes, he'd like to do that. So I parked, we went in, and the majesty, the prayer, the holiness of the place was palpable. And we walked through past the pews and to the back. It was a large wood statue of Jesus Christ crucified. There were candles that were lit, and there was a place where you could put a dollar to get a candle and say a prayer. And I asked if he would like to do that. He said, yes. I gave him a dollar. He put it in the slot. He bowed his head in prayer. And then we went and sat in a pew. We were silent for 15 or 20 minutes. I looked at him, and he nodded, and we got up and we left. And I asked him the next day, would you like to go back to the cathedral? And he said he would. And we made that a part of every day, the spiritual part of him. And he was the only one in his family to have that relationship with Jesus. And that was when our relationship began. We began to bond even though he kept his distance, there was a different feel to being together, because every day we both had a spiritual experience in the cathedral. My path may be different, but holy is holy in my experience. I can be in a mosque, I can be in a synagogue, and I will get the experience of the holy. And so that began to change our relationship. It was, in a sense, a small but significant breakthrough. And then that allowed for the next breakthrough, which came unexpectedly when we went to a movie. When the movie ended, there were only four people in the theater. When the movie ended, I had some junior mints. A song played at the end of it. It was a Caribbean song. And he got up and he started dancing. And I got up and I was shaking the box of junior mints. And he vaulted over the railing in front of the screen and he started dancing wildly. So I got to see who he is through that moment. And he got to see me dancing with the junior mints. And that changed our relationship. And it was a breakthrough again. Allowed, I would say, by the breakthrough of being in the cathedral. And so fast forward, it's maybe a year later, I'm still working with him. And our relationship is a tight one. And this story is called The Ability of Love. I've worked with Daniel for about a year when he asks if I would take him to the roller skating rink in Santa Fe. I tell him I'll check with his parents. I call his mother and ask for permission. She and his father say yes. I tell Gina, who lives in the house with him, that I'll be stopping by at 6 p.m. on Friday to take Daniel roller skating. We arrive about a half hour after the rink opens for the night. Three people are roller skating around the rink as rock music plays and strobe lights flash against the walls. I immediately wish we weren't there. I've read speculation that flashing strobe lights can trigger seizures, and I've been told that Daniel occasionally has seizures and had been instructed what to do and all of that. And they can trigger seizures in some people on the autism spectrum. I consider telling Daniel that this isn't a good environment for him and we should leave, but he's been looking forward to this evening. I'm torn. He rents roller skates, and before he steps onto the rink, I feel compelled to say something to him about the flashing strobe lights. Daniel, I don't think this is the best place for you to be with the strobe lights. He says, they don't bother me. I've read that they may trigger seizures in some people. He shakes his head. That won't happen. How do you know? I want to stay. He steps onto the rink and skates away. I sit on one of two benches near the entrance to the rink's fast food restaurant and watch Daniel roller skate. I'm thinking maybe I should find the manager, explain the situation, and ask him or her to turn off the strobe lights while we're there. I'm told that the manager should be arriving soon. As Daniel roller skates with strobe lights flashing, he starts waving his arms in the air and shaking his head from side to side. People who have seen us together are unfazed by this occasional behavior, but people who aren't seen it, who haven't seen it, sometimes get nervous. I'm not sure what the reaction will be at the skating rink. There are now five people skating on the rink, and four of them glance uneasily at Daniel as he skates, waving his arms in the air and shaking his head. I walk to the edge of the rink and motion for him to skate over to me. He does so. I tell him, I think we should go now. Why, he asks. I think the strobe lights may be affecting you. They're not affecting me, he says. I don't want to leave. He steps back onto the rink and continues skating. I return to the bench where I've been sitting. A couple in their late 20s or early 30s rent roller skates and lace them up sitting on the bench next to me, to the one that I'm sitting on. We exchange hellos. They're both attractive and friendly. He says to me, we're visiting from San Francisco. This is our first time in Santa Fe. Welcome, I say. My name is Scott. I'm here with my friend, Daniel, who is skating. He says, my name is Roland. This is Alicia. He's tall and wears a plaid scarf around his neck. She has long black hair that hangs to her waist. Before they step onto the rink, Daniel skates past them, waving his arms in the air, moving his head from side to side. Roland and Alicia smile affectionately at each other and begin to skate. About a half hour later, they stop skating and talk, standing together, close to a rink wall. Then Roland skates off the rink, and we exchange friendly waves as he passes near me before entering the restaurant. Alicia continues to skate, gracefully circling the rink. Daniel's favorite movie is Beauty and the Beast. When we watched the movie in a Santa Fe movie theater, he knew and sang along with every song. And when I drove him home and we talked about the film, it became clear that he identified closely with both the prince and the beast, awakened by a kiss. Sitting on a bench near the rink's restaurant, I watch as Daniel skates over to Alicia. They stop skating and stand together as skaters pass them. He speaks close to her ear, takes her hand in his, and they skate around the rink as if they are a couple. Oh no, I say out loud. I stand and walk close to the rink Daniel and Alicia skate past me, hand in hand, and he looks happier than I've ever seen him. I turn toward the restaurant as Roland walks out holding a tray with wrapped food and two drinks in paper cups on it. He sees Daniel and Alicia skating together, holding hands, and he says, "What?" My mind races. Should I tell him that Daniel is on the autism spectrum and right now he's imagining himself to be a prince? I could explain that he's not delusional. He just gets into the role. But what difference would that make? Should I walk onto the rink and tell Daniel I need to talk with him? Yes, but before I can do that, they skate closer to where we are, and he tries to twirl her. They lose their balance, and he crashes down hard on top of her, pinning one of her legs beneath him. She cries out in pain, and her cry doesn't stop. Daniel takes her hand and tries to console her as Roland and I dash to her side. Daniel stands as we arrive. I take him by the arm and say, "Let's go over there." I walk with him about 8 feet away. Roland kneels by Alicia's side and asks, "Where are you hurt?" She says, "My left leg." He picks her up in his arms and carries her to one of the benches and gently places her on it. She lies down on the bench. The manager of the rink appears and hurries to her side. He asks, "Are you okay?" She says, "I don't know. Do you need to go to the hospital emergency room?" "No," she says, "I don't think so. Do you want an ice pack?" "Yes." He walks quickly to the restaurant and reappears a few minutes later holding an ice pack wrapped in a cloth. Roland takes it and asks Alicia, "Where should I place this?" She puts his right hand on her left knee. "Here." He kneels in front of her and places the ice pack against her leg's knee. Daniel walks to them and kneels in front of Alicia to the right of Roland. I stand near Daniel. He takes one of her hands in his two hands and says, "I'm sorry." He kisses her hand. She smiles at him. "It was an accident. I'm going to be okay." "Daniel," I say, "let's give them some space." "I'm so sorry," he tells her. He stands and we walk about 8 feet away. About 15 minutes later, Roland asks Alicia if she can stand and put weight on her leg. She says she'll try. He helps her stand and holds her as she gingerly takes a step, then another. "It hurts," she says, "but nothing's broken. I don't think anything's torn." We're all relieved to hear that. "Should we stay?" I ask them. "No," she says, "I'll be okay." I write my name and number on a piece of paper and hand it to Roland. "I'm so very sorry this happened," I say to both of them. "Call me if you decide to see a doctor." Roland thanks me. We all say goodbye. And I never hear from them. Daniel returns his roller skates, and after we get in the car, he asks me, "Are you mad at me?" "No," I say, "I'm not mad at you." "How do you feel about what happened?" "Sad that she got hurt, but I liked skating with her." I drive him home. Gina greets us and asks him, "How did it go?" "Good," he says. He walks to his room and shuts the door. I tell Gina what happened, and in the morning I email Robin and let her know as well. When I return home, I think about Alicia and Roland and how they both handled the situation with compassion when they could have been angry. They could have blamed Daniel for the accident and me for not stopping him when he started skating with her. But they don't. I think about when Daniel skated to Alicia and spoke to her, took her hand in his, and skated blissfully around the rink. She allowed that to happen without awkwardness or rejection. She saw a handsome young man with a disability who wanted to hold her hand and skate around the rink as if they were a couple, and she gave him the moment he had dreamed of and perhaps prayed for.
Well, hearing you read it is even more powerful. In all of the stories, you've met people where they were. You suddenly met me where I was back in 2007 to 2009. Numbers aren't my friend. And that goes to show you, I mean, the title of your second book, Mentoring Human Potential, it's really what you strive to do in your life. And that's all through the stories, particularly later in your life, professionally, but even, well, through your professional life period. And so you mentioned what you're doing now is helping people write their own stories and find healing and understanding through writing their own stories. As we end this evocative episode, please talk about what writing your own memoir want you and how you take what you've learned in writing your own memoir and striving to help others with disabilities and those who have yet to discover their own disabilities tell their stories.
Well, I thought about this and decided to just write a few paragraphs about the benefits of writing one's memoir. And I think that the benefits apply to all people with known disabilities or unknown disabilities. People with unknown disabilities may discover that they have a disability just by writing their stories, because patterns emerge. Themes of life, what do you see repeated in these stories? And so I'd like to read these paragraphs because I wanted to express a train of thought and to respond spontaneously. That's what I like, but in certain instances, I like to write my thoughts down. So this is what I wrote on the benefits of writing your memoir. Our most important true stories are the ones we remember years after they happen. These life-shaping stories live on in our memories and the memories of the people we tell them to. But it is difficult to grasp the meaning of our stories until we write them and write a second draft and a third, thinking about the story between drafts until its personal meaning is understood fully. The process of writing several drafts of our most memorable true stories is therapeutic. The process brings forth meaning, which is a catalyst for personal growth. Each story is a mirror reflecting who we are and how we deal with a situation that turns into a story. This was certainly true for me when I wrote my Out of the Blue stories. On my book's website, outofthebluestories.com, I wrote, "The benefits of writing a memoir are well worth the considerable effort required. I speak from experience. Writing my memoir gave me an opportunity to gain insights into my long-term patterns and character traits revealed through the stories I chose to write. If you are thinking about writing your memoir or have begun writing it and would like the help I offer as a memoir writing coach, my website describes how we would work together. Visit outofthebluestories.com." Writing my book, writing the stories was enormously helpful for me to be able to release myself from certain traumas. And we all have traumas. We do. And some of them play themselves out in our head like a loop, an unceasing loop. And there are times when those traumas may express themselves in other stories. So I got to see that by writing my stories. I got to see that, and I can say that some of the deepest traumas, I was released from them by writing them and rewriting them and rewriting them and thinking about them, and then just experiencing that they were no longer who I am. I am not that trauma. So I hope that if anyone listening to this podcast or viewing this podcast is thinking about writing a memoir, you may want to just do it yourself without any help. You may not, it may be helpful even if you don't show it to anyone. Or you may want to make a book out of them and give it to family members. They will then get to know you in a much fuller way. And I hope, and if you want to work with me, then go to my website and we can have some email exchanges and set that up. Regardless of whether you work with me or do it on your own, the benefit and benefits of writing your memoir, I can't overstate them. They're very important for seeing a 360. It's like walking around your life with the stories of your life and getting a panoramic experience of them, and then tying pieces together that reveal who you are and who you are becoming. Because those stories can appear static, but more meaningful than they are in terms of who you are right now.
Well, my friend, I've certainly enjoyed this extended conversation, like I have all of our conversations. I want to thank you again for sharing everything you shared. And I hope that our next conversation we're able to have in person without looking at each other through a screen. It's been quite a long time since we've actually been in the same room. I've enjoyed your memoir immensely. It's written in a way that certainly I had never experienced or thought possible, but it works beautifully, and you should be extremely proud of the stories you've chosen to illustrate a life that both personally and professionally has been advocating for others and advocating with others to live a life of love and service to their fellow human being. Because no one gets out of this experience unharmed, untraumatized, but most importantly, no one gets out of that experience by themselves. And so we all share a collective story, and that has always been a part of your mission, both personally and professionally, and something that I've taken away from my time with you, and something that I deeply admire you for.
Thank you, Keith, and thank you for inviting me to be on your podcast, which I think is, talk about service and talk about love. This is an act of love, and this is an act of service. The contribution that you're making with this podcast is a deeply moving one. And I know the courage that it takes to create what you've created. And I really admire what you've accomplished. And I thank you for your beautiful friendship for all these years. Thank you.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guests, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcasts. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.